Well, hello once again, ladies and gentlemen. The MSS crew would like to thank you for joining us here in the Fred Bertelsen Memorial Old Time Radio Room of RadioOutOfThePast.org. And this is your MSS host, Luis Jr., assisting with bringing to you yet another exciting and exhilarating internet broadcast of Michael's Saturday Night Surprise. So everybody, open up your ears for the OTR stylings of Joy Jackson. So let's just take a minute here to sit back, relax, grab a cold drink and a snack, and enjoy the program. JJ, the microphone is yours.
Thanks, Luis. Welcome to the MSS edition of Treasures Old and New from ART. We start off with I Love Mystery, the lost shows of Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge. High in the Sierras, Jack, Doc, and Jerry are snowed in at Frozen Corpse Lodge. And if you've been wondering where that is located, the clue was in episode 1. It indicated it was west of Reno. Well, which is up Donner Pass. Since the narrator has a page and a half of description, I'll let him at it. Episode 5 of The Terror at Frozen Corpse Lodge.
American Radio Theater presents I Love a Mystery. A new Carlton E. Morse adventure thriller, Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge. One o'clock in the morning, snowbound and stormbound in J. Irving Stark's hunting lodge, high in the Sierras, somewhere on the California-Nevada line. Jerry Booker, the snappiest private secretary in Hollywood, with her bosses Jack and Doc, are guests of Stark and his daughter, Gail. They came in the guise of guests, but mainly they are here because of a strange terror which is dogging Gail Stark's heels. The last three men she kissed died violently within 24 hours. Doc and Jack are to find out why, but none of the others at the lodge for the weekend know that. These include Gail's fiancé, Bruce Garrett, the ancient butler, Mansfield, P.O., the lodge's cook and caretaker, and two men who had no business being there at all. One of them was Jones, the new butler. He sticks to his story that an employment agency in Reno had orders to send him to the lodge. The second man is A.J. Ben, who walked in out of the night and said that he had become lost in the snowstorm and asked for lodging for the night. As the night progressed and the lodge became snowed in, desperate events began to transpire. The telephone and radios were smashed. Old Mansfield whispered to Jack that he had a story of murder to tell when they could be alone. Bruce Garrett made a slurring remark about Jerry Booker, and Doc knocked him unconscious. And finally, P.O., the caretaker, on his way from the stable to the lodge, found the murdered body of a man frozen in a snowbank. And Gail Stark recognized him as a friend whom she'd kissed goodbye in Reno less than 24 hours ago. The fourth man to receive her kiss of death. And now at 1 o'clock in the morning, Jack and Doc are putting the screws on the entire personnel, one by one, as Jerry sits with a shorthand book on an artistically crossed knee, jotting down notes.
Yeah, come on, Miss Stark. Right in the tap room, or whatever you call it.
Yes, of course.
Here's Gail Stark, Jack.
Okay. You better go back to the trophy room and keep the rest quiet.
Okay. Yell when you want the next one. Don't be long.
Hey, just what is this?
Please, be seated.
Well, yeah, sure, but all this hocus pocus. Jerry with her shorthand book and being herded around and...
Don't give it a thought, Gail. It's all in a day's work.
Well, yeah, but you came up here to protect me, not ask me questions, remember?
Sorry, we've got to ask questions to protect you. Jerry's notebook's just so Doc and I can study everyone's answers at our leisure.
Well, okay. But I'd a lot rather do my talking off the record.
Don't worry. This is off the record. You're my client, so what you have to say is just between you and me.
Oh, so no one else will know what goes down in Jerry's book?
Right.
Oh, well, swell. That's different.
Good. First, what's the name of the dead man Pio found in the snow?
Philip Ogden.
And just a word, who is he and what is he?
He's a son of Arthur Jameson Ogden, the motion picture producer.
Upper crust, huh?
Yes. Money, position, everything to live for. He was in my social set in Hollywood.
The same set as the other three young men whom you kissed and who were killed?
Yes.
Uh-huh. How did you happen to kiss young Ogden goodbye in Reno yesterday?
Well, I was just saying goodbye, and I leaned over and gave him a kiss on the cheek. It wasn't anything.
Just casual, huh?
Yes, I wouldn't have remembered it at all, only...
Only what? You getting all this, Jerry?
Oh, sure.
Well, only the minute I did it, I remembered the other three, and a horrible chill crept up my spine.
Uh-huh. You knew you'd sealed his fate?
Of course not. How could I know anything like that?
But you said...
I only meant the terrible thing that had happened to the other three. Couldn't help wondering if I'd wished the same fate on Philip.
Well, apparently you had.
Yes.
Do you think there is somebody close to you who is resenting these young men?
Well, he doesn't love them, I should imagine.
Somebody close to you.
What? Oh, you mean Bruce Garrett?
Or your father?
Are you suggesting that Bruce or father is responsible for four murders?
No, I'm asking you.
Well, naturally, my father's out.
Why naturally?
Just because he is. Because it's too absurd to even consider. Because
what?
Because he's a fine man, and I won't even think about such a thing in connection with him.
Hey, Gail, don't be a fool.
What?
Well, tell him the truth about yourself and J. Irving Stark.
You know?
Of course I do, and so does everyone else.
I suppose so.
What are you talking about?
Well, J. Irving isn't really my father.
Oh?
My mother married him when I was a little girl.
Stepdaughter, huh?
Yes.
Does that make any difference?
I don't see how. I don't even know why Jerry thought it was necessary to bring it out.
Look, Jack, if that's all Gail's going to say, I'm going to put in my 2 cents worth. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, and maybe it does.
Well, go ahead.
Gail's mother married J. Irving years ago, yeah. But when she married, she put Gail in a girls' school and kept her there, except for a vacation now and then.
Jerry, I think that's horrible of you.
Why?
Well, Gail's ma had the idea that her life with J. Irving would be snugger if there wasn't a pretty growing girl around the house for her husband to see.
Is that true, Miss Stark?
Yes.
Yeah, well, Gail's ma died about a year ago, and J. Irving immediately brought Gail back into the house as his daughter.
Well, all through the years he used to come and see me when Mother didn't know. When I was little, he brought me candy and flowers, and when I was older, he sent me books and theater tickets and slipped me extra money for good times.
All this without your mother's knowledge?
Yes, he's always been so kind and generous and... Well, the only real parent I ever had.
Do you think he's in love with you?
As a father who's seen me grow up from a little girl, yes, very much so. Just as I'd love and honor him as my father.
Uh-huh. Then you don't think he could possibly be doing all this as a jealous older man determined to keep young men your own age away?
No, of course not. It's unthinkable.
Uh-huh. And now what about Bruce Garrett?
I can't conceive of anyone committing a murder, so naturally I can't believe it of Bruce.
But you don't like him.
I'm engaged to marry him.
Which makes your dislike all the stranger. Why?
Why am I going to marry him? Because I promised in a moment of weakness, and I pride myself in keeping my promises.
No, I meant, why do you dislike him so much?
Because I think he's the most egotistical, self-centered man I ever met with a streak of unutterable cruelty running through him.
And you don't think that's enough to justify you in breaking off the engagement?
No. Well, at least not just yet.
I don't follow you. I mean, what do you mean?
No.
But you said...
I said no, didn't I? That's all there is. Just no.
Uh-huh. His having more millions than he knows what to do with wouldn't have anything to do with your sticking to him, would it?
That's unutterably crude, Mr. Packard.
I know. But answer the question just the same.
I happen to be independently wealthy in my own right, if you must know.
From your mother or your stepfather?
No, J. Irving is...
Yes?
Nothing.
All right. Now, one thing more about the dead man. Ogden, what was he doing in Reno?
I don't know.
Didn't you ask him?
No, he's always around someplace. You know, the Playboy type. One weekend in Reno, the next in Palm Springs, and the next on Broadway.
I see. I think you'd better go to bed, Miss Stark. You look all in.
You mean you're through?
Yes. Will you ask your father to come in as you go out?
Yes, of course.
Oh, Miss Stark.
Yes?
You'll please not discuss our talk with anyone.
No, of course not.
Jack, I just thought of something.
Yes?
Well, why didn't J. Irving identify the body if he was a close friend of Gail?
Good girl. His answer might be very interesting. Oh, come in, Mr. Stark.
Yes, certainly. Shall I close the door?
If you will. Sit right here, please.
Certainly. I see they have the sharpest secretary in Hollywood busy tonight.
That's right, up to my armpits in shorthand characters.
So this is how a murder investigation is conducted?
This is our method. Mr. Stark, why did you tell us you didn't know the dead man?
Because I don't.
You want to stick to that, do you?
I most certainly want to stick to the truth as I know it.
So you maintain you don't know and never heard of Philip Ogden.
Philip Ogden? No, I don't know any Philip Ogden.
Isn't that a little queer, considering that he's been a member of your daughter's social set since she was a debutante?
He was?
Wouldn't you know?
No, I wouldn't know.
Well, I repeat, isn't it a little odd?
But you see, I...
Well?
Well, as a matter of fact, the relationship between my daughter, that is, between Gail and myself, isn't exactly what it appears on the surface.
How do you mean?
Well, she isn't my daughter, actually. I mean, she's my stepdaughter. Until a year ago, when her mother died, she was raised away from me at girls' schools and later at a resident college.
But why?
Her mother was, well, to put it bluntly, her mother was jealous of her.
Uh-huh.
So you can see, Gail has had the opportunity of forming numerous friends, many of whom I've never met.
That's all down, Jerry?
Every word.
But why are you taking down my words?
Doesn't mean anything. Just our method of checking each person's story against the others.
Sure, J. Irving, relax. Cigarette?
Thank you, Jerry.
Sure. We're among friends.
Mr. Stark, did Gail tell you that she kissed this boy goodbye in Reno yesterday?
What? What did you say?
Yes. And 24 hours later, he's dead. Just as those three other young men.
What? What are you talking about? What about those three others?
You knew that three friends of Gail's had, on three separate occasions, entered liquor stores 15 minutes after midnight with guns in their hands, had said, "This is a stick-up," and had been shot to death by police shotgun squads for resisting arrest?
Yes.
You knew that?
Yes.
In each case, the young man to die that night had told her he was going away, and she had kissed him goodbye.
Just as she'd done the Ogden boy in Reno.
Mm-hmm. Just as she'd done the Ogden boy in Reno. Well, what about it, Stark? How do you think these four young men came to their deaths?
This is fantastic.
Did you know the first three?
I knew one of them. The other two I knew by name.
Do you think they were part of a gang of criminals?
It seems incredible.
What about their families? Haven't they demanded any investigation?
They've been so heartsick, all they wanted to do was crawl into their holes and die.
Uh-huh. Well, tell me, Stark. Do you think the kisses your stepdaughter has given these men have anything to do with their murders?
It seems incredible. There must be coincidence.
Well, what are your feelings toward Gail?
What? What are you saying? What are you implying?
Answer me. Are you in love with that girl?
What kind of a person do you think I am? I've watched over her since she was a tiny girl. I have given her my name and I have honored her with my home. I think what you are suggesting is just about the foulest implication one person could make to another. You'll excuse me, please.
One more question.
Not another word. You have taken advantage of my hospitality. I would be within my rights to put you out, snowstorm or no snowstorm. First murder and now this. I am going to my bedroom. Mansfield will take care of your needs.
Oh, boy. Did you step into something up to your armpits?
Looks like it, doesn't it? You got it all down?
Yeah, I got it. But he had me scratching like a chicken there at the end.
I rubbed him the wrong way, no doubt. Yes?
Hi. What the heck did you folks do to Mr. Stark? Man, he stopped off to bed looking like a feller that ate too many green apples.
Doc, you're supposed to be watching the people in the trophy room.
Yeah, well, Mr. Stark went up without saying anything, so I had to come up and see who you want to talk to next.
Sending Gail Stark's fiancé. He's conscious, isn't he?
Bruce Garrett? Oh, sure, he's conscious, okay, but man, has he got a mean disposition.
Send him in.
Okay, you handle him with gloves. He's likely to be giving you hydrophobia. He's so mad. I'll go get him.
Golly, Jack, do you realize it's 1 o'clock?
Are you getting tired?
Who isn't?
Okay, there's only 2 more people I want to talk to tonight. The rest can wait.
Bruce Garrett and who else?
Mansfield.
The old butler? What can he offer?
You keep getting madder, sport, and you're going to blow up. Bust right in front of our eyes.
I'm going to do something you'll regret for the rest of your life. You take hold of me once more.
Here is, Jack, a frothin' and a foamin'.
Sit down, Garrett.
The little Gestapo, huh?
Go back and keep the rest herded together, Doc.
Okay, son.
Garrett, answer me something.
Depends.
Are you naturally as mean as you pretend, or are you putting on an act to cover up something?
Oh, listen to the great analytical mind analyzing, the great detective detecting.
You hate detectives. Why should a man as wealthy as you hate anything as lowly and inoffensive as a private operator?
I'll tell you that if you'll tell me why you think I'm not as mean as I pretend.
Certainly. Gail Stark would never have got herself engaged to a man as continuously vicious as you have been since we arrived. More than that, every man has his violent moments, but no one, except madmen, stays in a state of overwrought emotion.
What did you say? Are you calling me a madman?
Pick up your chair and sit down.
Oh, how dare you call me mad? I'm as sane as anyone in this room. Madness? Ha! If you want madness, look elsewhere in this lodge of the frozen corpse.
This has been a presentation of a lost old-time radio show by American Radio Theater. I Love a Mystery was written by Carlton C. Morse. This was Book 25, Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge, directed by Marge Lutton, assisted by Greg Porter, and produced by Joy Jackson. In our cast, you heard Cole Hornaday as Jack Packard, Reynaud LaBeouf as Doc Long, with Joy Jackson as Jerry Booker, Melinda Maines as Gail Stark, Michael Moki O'Reilly as Pio, Greg Porter as A.J. Benn and the narrator, Dan Schindler as J. Irving Stark, Kim Turner as Mansfield. Live sound effects by Penny Swanberg and Marilyn Welt. Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge was originally broadcast on May 22 to June 14, 1951. I'm Pat McNally, whom you also heard as Bruce Garrett and Jones the Butler. This is ART, American Radio Theater.
My next show is from the days of old-time radio. But first, I have to share a story told me by Christopher Conrad, the son of William Conrad, the actor. When Christopher was a teenager, he found a stack of reel-to-reel tapes in the trash can in the family room. "What's this?" he asked his dad. "Ah, just radio junk I'm getting rid of." Chris took the top tape into his room and played it on his reel-to-reel player. He was astounded at the storytelling quality of his dad's voice. He marched back out into the family room and saved the rest of the tapes.
The only reason the following show exists is that Chris saved the master tape that day. Here's Bill Conrad as writer, producer, and actor of a show called 1,489 Words, broadcast on CBS Radio Workshop, February 10, 1957.
From Hollywood, the CBS Radio Workshop. They say one picture is worth 10,000 words. I wonder, is it? CBS Radio presents the CBS Radio Workshop, dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. The theater of the mind, where words create pictures. Here, then, are 1,489 words, the voice of William Conrad and the music of Jerry Goldsmith. Mr. Conrad.
Thank you. With no prejudice against pictures that are worth 10,000 words, we will bring you in the next half hour 1,489 words, which are worth innumerable pictures. Exactly how many, only you can tell, for, well, it's the magic of your imagination that will paint them. We begin with 956 words arranged by the English poet Alfred Noyes into a pattern he called The Highwayman. Mr. Goldsmith, if you please, overture for The Highwayman. Was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees. The moon was a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas. The road was a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor. And the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The highwayman came riding up to the old inn door. He'd a French cock hat on his forehead, a bunch of lace at his chin, a coat of the claret velvet, and his breeches of brown doeskin. They fitted with never a wrinkle. His boots were up to the thigh. And he rode with a jeweled twinkle. His pistol butts a twinkle. His rapier held a twinkle under the jeweled sky. Over the cobbles he clattered and clashed in the dark inn yard. And he tapped with his whip on the shutters. But all was locked and barred. He whistled a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess. The landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into her long black hair. And dark in the dark old inn yard, a staple wicket creaked where Tim the ostler listened. His face was white and peaked, his eyes were hollows of madness, his hair like moldy hay. But he loved the landlord's daughter, the landlord's red-lipped daughter. Dumb as a dog, he listened, and he heard the robber say, "One kiss, my bonny sweetheart, I'm after a prize tonight, but I shall be back with the yellow gold before the morning lights. Yet if they press me sharply and harry me through the day, then look for me by moonlight. Watch for me by moonlight. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." He rose upright in his stirrups. He scarce could reach her hand, but she loosened her hair in the casement. His face burned like a brand as the black cascade of perfume came tumbling o'er his breast. And he kissed its waves in the moonlight, oh, sweet black waves in the moonlight. Then he tugged at his rein in the moonlight and galloped away to the west. Not come in the dawning, he did not come at noon, and out of the tawny sunset before the rise of the moon, when the road was a gypsy's ribbon looping the purple moor, a red coat troop came marching, marching, marching. King George's men came marching up to the old inn door. They said no word to the landlord, they drank his ale instead, but they gagged his daughter and bound her to the foot of her narrow bed. Two of them knelt at a casement with muskets at their side. There was death at every window, and hell at one dark window. For Bess could see through her casement the road that he would ride. They had tied her up to attention with many a sniggering jest. They had bound a musket beside her with a barrel beneath her breast. Now keep good watch. And they kissed her. She heard the dead man say, "Look for me by moonlight, watch for me by moonlight, I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell should bar the way." She twisted her hands behind her, but all the knots held good. She writhed her hands till her fingers were wet with sweat or blood. They stretched and strained in the darkness, and the hours crawled by like years, till now, on the stroke of midnight, cold on the stroke of midnight, the tip of one finger touched it. The trigger, at least, was hers. The tip of one finger touched it. She strove no more for the rest. Up she stood to attention with a barrel beneath her breast. She would not risk her hearing. She would not strive again. For the road lay bare in the moonlight, blank and bare in the moonlight. And the blood of her veins in the moonlight throbbed to her love's refrain. Plot, plot, had they heard it? The horse hoofs ringing clear. Plot, 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 plot in the distance. Were they deaf that they did not hear? Down the ribbon of moonlight over the brow of the hill, the highwayman came riding, riding, riding. The redcoats looked to their priming. She stood up straight and still. Plot, plot in the frosty silence. Plot, plot in the echoing night. Nearer he came and nearer. Her face was like a light. Her eyes grew wide for a moment. She drew one last deep breath. Then her finger moved in the moonlight. Her musket shattered the moonlight. Shattered her breast in the moonlight. And warned him with her death. He turned, he spurred to the west. He did not know who stood bowed with her head or the musket drenched with her own red blood. Not till dawn he heard it. His face grew gray to hear how Bess, the landlord's daughter, the landlord's black-eyed daughter, had watched for her love in the moonlight and died in the darkness there. Back he spurred like a madman, shrieking a curse to the sky, with a white road smoking behind him, and his rapier brandished high. Blood red were his spurs in the golden noon. Wine red was his velvet coat when they shot him down on the highway, down like a dog on the highway, and he lay in his blood on the highway with a bunch of lace at his throat.
Mm-hmm.
And still, of a winter's night, they say, when the wind is in the trees, when the moon is a ghostly galleon tossed upon cloudy seas, when the road is a ribbon of moonlight over the purple moor, a highwayman comes riding, riding, riding. A highwayman comes riding up to the old inn door. Over the cobbles he clatters and clangs in the dark inn yard, and he taps with his whip on the shutters, but all is locked and barred. He whistles a tune to the window, and who should be waiting there but the landlord's black-eyed daughter, Bess, the landlord's daughter, plaiting a dark red love knot into a long black hair. Now, love has always been the special province of poets, and who of us, having fallen in love or thought we had, has not tried to express this overwhelming passion in a poem? Well, more than 100 years ago, there was in London a young woman who managed this rather more successfully than most of us. Her name was Elizabeth Barrett. Her lover was Robert Browning, who tenderly called her his little Portuguese because of her dark complexion. As their romance progressed, she wrote him a series of sonnets inscribed from the Portuguese. Here is the immemorial Sonnet 43, 128 words of love. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for rights. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with a passion put to use in my old griefs, and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. They say one picture is worth 10,000 words. Do you still believe it? Well, listen then to 398 words from the pen of the late, great Thomas Wolfe, from his book of Time in the River, a passage known as The Thunder of Imperial Names.
imperial names. The names of men and battles, the names of places and great rivers, the mighty names of the states. The name of the wilderness, and the names of Antietam, Chancellorsville, Shiloh, Bull Run, Fredericksburg, Cold Harbor, the Wheat Fields, Ball's Bluff, and the Devil's Den. The names of Cowpens, Brandywine, and Saratoga, of Death Valley, the Chickamauga, and the Cumberland Gap. The names of the Nantahalas, the Badlands, the Painted Desert, the Yosemite, and the Little Bighorn. The names of Yancey and Cabarrus counties, and the terrible name of Hatteras. Then for the continental thunder of the states, the names of Montana, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, Michigan, Maryland, Virginia, and the two Dakotas, the names of Oregon and Indiana, of Kansas and the rich Ohio, the powerful name of Pennsylvania, and the name of old Kentucky, the undulance of Alabama, the names of Florida and North Carolina. Red oak thickets at the break of day, long hunters lay for bear. The rattle of arrows and laurel leaves, the war cries round the painted buttes, and the majestical names of the Indian nations, the Pawnees, the Algonquins, the Iroquois, the Comanches, the Blackfeet, the Seminoles, the Cherokees, the Sioux, the Hurons, the Mohawks, the Navajos, the Utes, the Omahas, the Onondagas, the Chippewas, the Crees, the Chickasaws, the Arapahos, the Catawbas, the Dakotas, the Apaches, the Croatans, and the Tuscaroras. The names of Powhatan and Sitting Bull, and the name of the great chief, Rain in the Face. Have you seen starlight on the rails? Have you heard the thunder of the fast express? The names of the mighty rails that bind the nation. The wheeled thunder of the names that net the continent. The Pennsylvania, the Union Pacific, the Santa Fe, the Baltimore and Ohio, the Chicago and Northwestern, the Southern, the Louisiana and Northern, the Seaboard Airline, the Chicago, Milwaukee and St. Paul, the Lackawanna, the New York, New Haven and Hartford, the Florida East Coast, the Rock Island and the Denver and Rio Grande. We'll be right back.
finally, the names of the great rivers that are flowing in the darkness. The names of the great mouths, the mighty maws, the vast, wet, coiling, never glutted and unending snakes that drink the continents. Where and in what other land will you find others like them? And where you can match the mighty music of their names? The Monongahela, the Colorado, the Rio Grande, the Columbia, the Tennessee, the Hudson, the Kennebec, the Rappahannock, the Delaware, the Penobscot, the Wabash, the Chesapeake, the Swananoa, the Indian River, the Niagara, the St. Lawrence, the Susquehanna, the Tom Bigbee, the Nantahala, the French Broad, the Chattahoochee, and the Potomac. A few of their princely names. These are a few of their great, proud, glittering names, fit for this immense and lonely land that they inhabit. Just a few more words and we're done. From the ancient Japanese, a tanka, a poem consisting of only 7 words. A poem called Silence. Butterfly sleeps on the temple bell.
The CBS Radio Workshop has presented 1489 Words, starring William Conrad, with music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith. 1489 Words consisted of The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes, Sonnet 43 from the Portuguese by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, The Thunder of Imperial Names by Thomas Wolfe, and Silence by an unknown Japanese poet of antiquity. This experiment in words and the pictures words evoke was directed by Mr. Conrad and produced in Hollywood by William N. Robeson. Next week, from New York, the workshop will present Space Merchants, directed by Paul Roberts.
Before I ride off into the sunset, here's episode 6 of The Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge.
American Radio Theater presents I Love a Mystery. One o'clock in the morning, snowbound and stormbound in J. Irving Stark's hunting lodge, high in the Sierras, somewhere on the California-Nevada line. Jerry Booker, the snappiest private secretary in Hollywood, with her bosses Jack and Doc, are guests of Stark and his daughter Gail. They came in the guise of guests, but mainly they are here because of a strange terror which is dogging Gail Stark's heels. The last 3 men she kissed died violently within 24 hours. Doc and Jack are to find out why, but none of the others at the lodge for the weekend know that. These include Gail's fiancé, Bruce Garrett, the ancient butler, Mansfield, P.O., the lodge's cook and caretaker, and 2 men who had no business being there at all. One of them was Jones, the new butler. He sticks to his story that an employment agency in Reno had orders to send him to the lodge. The second man is A.J. Benn, who walked in out of the night and said he had become lost in the snowstorm. As the night progressed and the lodge is snowed in, the telephone and radios are smashed. Old Mansfield whispered to Jack that he had a story of murder to tell when they can be alone. Bruce Garrett made a slurring remark about Jerry Booker, and Doc knocked him unconscious. And finally, Pio, the caretaker, on his way from the stable to the lodge, found the murdered body of a man, frozen in a snowbank. And Gail Stark recognized him as Philip Ogden, a wealthy friend from her social group, whom she'd kissed goodbye in Reno less than 24 hours ago. The fourth man to receive her kiss of death. It has been revealed that J. Irving Stark is not Gail's real father, but her stepfather. Little by little, the undercurrents and cross-currents which flow through this snowbound mountain hunting lodge begin to reveal themselves. And now, we find Doc in the trophy room where he is presiding.
Oh, doggone. 1:30 in the morning.
Begging your pardon, sir, but it's getting late and I have a difficult day before me tomorrow.
Yeah, you are kind of an old codger to be up at this time in the morning, Mansfield.
Perhaps if I could retire then.
Sorry, maybe you can sleep in tomorrow morning.
You feel obliged to keep me here?
Yep. Jack said everybody keeps herded together until he's had a chance to talk to you.
But Mama Diablo, if he talked to us so long as he talked Senorita Gale and Senor Stark, we will be here all night.
Well, don't rumple up your feathers at me, P.U. I ain't the one that's a-keeping you up.
Why'd you call me P.U.? Well, my name, she is P.O. Answer me that.
Okay, son, take it easy.
Well, for goodness sake, I am P.O., the caretaker of Frozen Corpse Lodge. Yes? No?
Why, sure.
See, and caretaker must get out of bed 5:30, 6 o'clock a.m. in the morning. Is it not so?
Yeah, I wouldn't be one mite surprised.
So why? I am kept up with a lot of big foolish men to 3 or 2 o'clock. You ask me that.
Yeah, don't worry. Jack and Jerry ain't going to be in the bar long with Bruce Garrett, I don't think. Mr. Ben, what's the matter with you and Jones here? I ain't had a word out of neither of you for an hour.
I'm just relaxing before the fire.
Yeah, you sure do look comfortable, all right.
That utterly glorious feeling of peace that comes over one before the warmth of the hearth, while outside the elements are raging, the absolute helplessness of being snowbound, and there's nothing to do but relax and enjoy it.
Well, I'll be doggone, a dirt poet.
Huh? This feller?
You don't like poets, P.O.?
No, I don't like poets. And also, I don't like you, I betcha.
Well, I'm sorry about that.
Ha! What I care about you if you are sorry. You're the kind of fella I bet you will take bath every day.
P.O., my man.
See? The kind of fella that have toothbrush at home, eh?
Yes, I have a toothbrush.
Didn't I tell you? One of them high monkey muck fellas. One of them pretty teeth fellas.
Doggone, sport. You can get more indignant about more stuff than any hombre I've ever met. What's the matter with you, Jones?
I'm cold, that's what's the matter. Can't they even afford to keep the fires in this place?
Yeah. Is anybody else cold?
I don't care whether anybody else is cold or not. I am.
Okay, P.U., go get another stick of wood.
Well, for my goodness sake, at this time of night?
Cut out the indignant and go get it.
Since when are you or my boss?
See this fist?
No, senor.
Well, you better see it on account as I'm just as liable as not to run it down your throat clean up to the elbow.
You would not do this thing.
Then go get some more wood.
See? With pleasure, senor.
And hurry back.
See? In 1 minute, I am back.
We're most extraordinary.
What did you say, Mansfield?
What's that, sir?
You muttered something to yourself.
Did I indeed? Sir, a very bad habit. I must break myself of it. Most disagreeable, I'm sure.
Hey, here's an idea. As long as Jones is here and him being a butler, how about him pitching in and helping you, Mansfield?
2 butlers on 1 position, sir?
Well, you ain't getting no sleep tonight, and after all, Jones here is a younger man.
But much less capable, I assure you.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Much less capable.
I've helped my own with the best of them, Grandpa.
Jones, I must ask you, do not refer to me as Grandpa.
Did you ever buttle for Smith Abbott's?
I never did.
Yeah, well, how about these Cyril Wesley Finchos?
Never. For 35 years, I've been Mr. J. Irving Stark's butler. That, my man, is a record of service you will never live to equal.
Well, Mr. Stark must want to get rid of you for now.
That is a prevarication without equal.
Hey, master, else why did he send for me?
He positively did not send for you.
Oh, that ain't the way I heard it, as the saying goes.
I refuse to quarrel with so low a person. Beg your pardon, Mr. Ben. Is there something wrong?
What? Oh, it's just that one of the globes is out in this floor lamp. I was unscrewing it to see whether it was burned out or whether there was a bad connection.
Yeah, are y'all an electrician?
Oh, I've puttered around it. Hello?
Hey, all the lights went out. Mr. Ben, did you monkey around and blow out a fuse?
No, I didn't even have my hands on the lamp when the lights went off.
Mansfield, y'all know where the fuse box is?
Quite so, sir. If you'll sit quietly, I'll go put another in place. It will take but a second, I'm sure.
Well, if this ain't a mess.
Hey, Doc, what's going on?
Ah, Jerry, lights have gone out.
Well, I'll say they've gone. Blacker than the inside of a cat.
Come on in the trophy room. There's a little light from the fireplace. Where's Jack?
I'm coming, too.
Can you find your way?
Oh, sure. Once we got a line on the fireplace. Ouch! Oh, my poor ankle.
You better sit down right here where you are.
Yeah, it'll be only be another minute. Mansfield's gone to put in another plug. Where's Bruce Garrett?
I let him go up to bed just before the lights went out. Jerry and I were checking our notes.
What the heck do you suppose happened? To the lights, I mean.
Oh, it was Mr. A.J. Ben here. He was a monkeying with the floor lamp, and Mansfield said it'd take him just a minute to fix it.
Is everyone else here?
Sure, except Flo.
Flo? Oh, P.O.
Yeah, I'll send him out for some more wood. Hey, he's taking a heck of a time at that.
The wood supply is in a shed in the back of the lodge. It would take him quite a while.
Is that you, Jones?
Oh, that's right, mister.
Hello? Hello, everybody.
Oh, there's P.O.
What's the matter with the lights?
Can you find your way, P.O.?
So I find my way. I know this place like a mama. But what I do not know is what happened to the lights.
We be able to fuse.
Put those logs on the fire. Maybe they'll give us enough light to see comfortably.
See? I have bring some green branches. That would make the big light. See, like this.
Wonderful.
Hey, where's Ben?
What's that?
Ben ain't here. He's a-sitting right over yonder.
And you say he was tampering with the light?
He blew the fuse sure as I'm a foot high.
Doc, you and Jerry stay here with Jones. Pio, you're coming with me.
I am?
Yes, you're going to show me where Mansfield went to change the fuses.
Mansfield? But in 1 minute, he will have the lights on.
Don't argue. Have you a candle or a flashlight or something?
See, here on mantel is kerosene lantern.
Good. Doc.
Yeah?
You and Jerry keep an eye on the stairs. Don't let anyone go up or down until I get back.
It's as good as done,
sure,
fella.
Sure, Jack.
All right. Bring your lantern. And come with me, P.O.
See? I will lead the way.
Where is the fuse box?
We go through this way into kitchen. And then down stairway into basement.
Kitchen?
See, la cocina. This is the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
This door is door to basement.
All right, let's go down.
See? Señor! Señor, look!
A body. Come on!
See? A body.
Hold it.
It is Mansfield, no?
Hold that lantern down here. No, it's Ben.
Señor A.J. Ben?
Yeah.
Oh, what a nasty blow.
He's come to, eh?
I can't find any bump or abrasion. Where were you hit?
Oh, what a nasty hit. Somewhere behind the ear, I think.
Here, what's this?
Señor, that is fuse plug that make lights go out.
What were you doing with a fuse plug, Ben?
A fuse plug?
Yes, a slightly used fuse plug.
Please, I can't think straight.
Pio, can you take these matches and go on down and put in a new plug?
Oh, see.
Here, take this plug, see if it works.
Si, senor, it's very minute.
Just what goes on here, Ben? Monkey with the lamp upstairs until you blow a fuse, slip away in the dark, and then pretend to have been knocked out?
But believe me, it's no pretense.
There's not a sign of a mark on you. What's this fuse plug business?
I tell you, I don't know anything about fuse plugs.
Then why did you come down here?
I thought Mansfield might be in danger.
Mansfield? Why?
I just did.
Danger from what?
I don't know.
That's pretty thin. Did you see Mansfield?
No, I just got down here to this first landing when something hit me from behind.
But if Mansfield... Ah, the lights.
There is light, senor.
Good work, P.O. Any sign of Mansfield down there?
No, senor. Mansfield, she's not here.
Come on back up.
See? First fuse I unscrew, she is one.
You use the fuse you found here?
See, she is good.
Uh-huh. Can you stand, Ben?
I think so.
Give him a hand, P.O.
See? Now, up with you, senor.
Thanks.
All right, let's go. I'll bring the lantern. I left the door open. Go right in through the kitchen. Right into the trophy room. This way.
Hey, Jack. Is that you?
Yeah. Has Mansfield come back?
Heck no. Didn't you find him up at the fuse box? Hey, what's the matter with Mr. Ben?
Slugged, he says.
He does look kind of green around the gills.
Oh, that's a doggone shame. Here, sit before you fall.
Thank you.
Anybody go up on the second floor or come down?
Nary a soul.
Okay, Doc. You stay here with Pio and Ben and Jones. I'm taking Jerry upstairs with me.
Well, what's that for?
Can't you get it through your head that Mansfield's missing?
Oh, yeah, but...
Never mind. Just keep these three men right in this room together until we get back. Come on, Jerry.
Okay. What do we do? Ransack the bedrooms?
But take it easy on the stairs. You know which rooms belong to who, don't you?
Yeah, sure.
When you get at the head of the stairs, I want you to take me to Gale Stark's room. Don't talk any more than you have to.
Yeah, okay. This way. Here. This one.
Uh-huh.
You're gonna go right in without knocking?
Yes, that's why I wanted you along.
Golly!
I'm not going to make a sound opening the door. Now, here we go.
And this will teach you to bring private detectives around me.
Bruce, you're choking me. Stop it.
Hey, you big ape.
Okay, so it's the snoopers.
Gale, honey, are you all right?
Get out of this room.
Yes, we seem to be interrupting something.
Well, then get out.
It wasn't a little exercise in murder, was it? Thought I saw you with Miss Stark flat on the bed with your knee in the pit of her stomach, choking and shaking her. What about it, Gale?
I'm letting go. That's what I get for getting myself engaged to a jealous maniac.
Maniac! This is the second time I've been called that tonight.
Well, there's one thing, sport. If it was you in here making Miss Stark's teeth rattle, y'all couldn't have nothing to do with making Mansfield disappear.
Did you say Mansfield?
He disappeared?
Yes. You got any ideas?
No. Of course not. Huh. Or maybe I have. Perhaps we're going to have a use for the new butler after all.
This has been a presentation of a lost old-time radio show by American Radio Theater. I Love a Mystery was written by Carlton C. Morse. This was Book 25, Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge, directed by Marge Lutton, assisted by Greg Porter, and produced by Joy Jackson. In our cast, you heard Cole Hornaday as Jack Packard, Reynaud LaBeouf as Doc Long, with Joy Jackson as Jerry Booker, Melinda Maines as Gale Stark, Michael Mokey O'Reilly as P.O., Greg Porter as A.J. Ben and the narrator, Dan Schindler as J. Irving Stark, Kim Turner as Mansfield. Live sound effects by Penny Swanberg and Marilyn Welt. Terror of Frozen Corpse Lodge was originally broadcast on May 22 to June 14, 1951. I'm Pat McNally, whom you also heard as Bruce Garrett and Jones the Butler. This is ART, American Radio Theater.
Gee, that's all I've got time for today. Come hang out with us every Saturday. Oh, and don't forget about the 12-hour marathon on August 30. See you then. Over to you, Louise.
Okay, JJ, thanks a lot, and great work. Well, folks, it is that time again. The MSS Express has reached the end of the line, so I am going to have to gently but firmly conduct each and every one of you off of the train. But don't worry, we will be back again next week, hooking you up with the most high-quality OTR surprises that are within our powers to produce. So, as usual, if you have any questions, comments, requests, or maybe even a complaint, please address them via email to mikeamelli@earthlink.net. That's MIKEAMELI@earthlink.net. We will soon be releasing the key and turning over the room to you, the listening audience. Please do with it as you wish, for as long as you wish. But just remember, be nice to one another. Otherwise, myself and JJ will be coming after you. So, have a great night, a great weekend, and goodbye.